From Maine Public Radio and MainePublic.org, I'm Jennifer Mitchell, bringing you the news on this day in Maine, December 26th, 2018. And on this day, Maine Governor-elect Janet Mills taps a Brunswick educator to lead the State Department of Education. And a closer look at how the New England power pool works and how it affects what you pay for electricity. Those stories and more ahead in a moment.
This Day in Maine is made possible by listeners like you and by Norway Savings, supporting the colorful vision of Maine's business owners. Live your life in color. NorwaySavings.bank.
Auburn attorney Seth Carey, who ran unsuccessfully for district attorney in Oxford, Franklin, and Androscoggin counties while his law license was suspended, will be banned from practice for 3 years. A Superior Court judge found that Carey violated rules of professional conduct by engaging in unlawful sexual contact and witness tampering. Attorney Jim Hawanek says his client continues to deny allegations of sexual assault.
As far as what we intend to do moving forward, we have, I believe, 21 days to decide whether we're going to appeal the decision to the Maine Supreme Court. Of course, we have to be cautious moving forward on that issue, because when you appeal, you can get a better result or you can also get a worse result.
The Board of Overseers of the Bar had been seeking Carey's disbarment, but because Carey acknowledged mental health issues, the judge said he should be given an opportunity to address the problems. Governor-elect Janet Mills is choosing a veteran teacher and administrator to serve as the state's next commissioner of education. Mills today announced that she's picked Brunswick Assistant Superintendent Pender Macon. Lawmakers, teachers, and school administrators are expressing optimism about the choice after years of revolving leadership in the department. Robbie Fine reports.
In her more than 20 years in education, Pender Macon has served in a variety of roles across Maine schools. She began her teaching career in Westbrook before becoming principal of The Real School, an alternative school on Falmouth's Mackworth Island, serving at-risk students from across southern Maine. 3 years ago, she became the assistant superintendent of the Brunswick School Department. In a press conference announcing Macon's nomination, Governor-elect Janet Mills said that breadth of experience should allow her to provide needed guidance to schools across the state.
The people of Maine will find a compassionate, caring, and innovative educator who will provide the long-awaited, steady, and reliable leadership at the State Department of Education.
That leadership has been inconsistent in recent years. The Department of Education didn't have a permanent commissioner for more than 2 years beginning in 2015, as Governor Paul LePage instead nominated a series of acting commissioners to head the department. According to local officials, that instability led to a lack of trust between the department and local districts. Steve Bailey, the executive director of the Maine School Management Association, says he feels optimistic that Macon can rebuild that trust.
And so we're really looking forward to some sustainability of leadership, as well as some recreation of trust, as well as support and confidence in leadership.
Macon says she wants to listen to schools and help them recover from what she terms mandate fatigue following several new statewide requirements over the past 8 years. Those include new teacher evaluation systems and a 2012 proficiency-based diploma law that would have required students to show proficiency in several subjects, like math, English, and science, in order to graduate. After pushback from parents and teachers, lawmakers got rid of that mandate earlier this year. Macon also hopes to look towards methods of accountability beyond standardized tests, which she says don't accurately reflect what's happening in Maine schools.
Our schools do so much more, and our students are so much more than their test scores. It's time to stop overlooking indicators of success simply because they're difficult to measure or to plot on a graph.
At Wednesday's press conference, Macon laid out educational priorities that are largely in line with those of the governor-elect. They include increasing teacher pay and implementing universal pre-K programs for four-year-olds. Maine voters also passed a referendum in 2016 to raise the state share of education funding to 55%, a number that it's yet to reach. Mills says she hopes to get to that number as part of her first budget proposal.
That's one of the big-ticket items, one of the items that we expect to prioritize, teacher salaries, and getting to 55% somehow, some way, and focusing on early childhood education.
Several education groups, including the State Teachers Union, were positive about Mills' choice. Maine Education Association President Grace Levitt says she's encouraged by Macon's work in the classroom, particularly with at-risk students, and is optimistic that Macon will advocate for underserved students in schools.
And so really knowing that this is somebody that will be championing what is needed for all students in our schools is just refreshing.
And Ed Cervone, the executive director of the business-led educational lobbying group Educate Maine, says he believes that Macon's varied experiences will help her to find common ground on policy issues and support the needs of local schools in both urban and rural communities of Maine.
To, you know, meet with the various stakeholders and figure out how to make that partnership real and effective.
The legislature will need to hold a public hearing and vote on Macon's nomination in the coming weeks before she can be confirmed. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Robbie Feinberg.
And for disclosure, the Maine Education Association represents most of Maine Public's news staff. So here's a question for you. Do you know where that power came from or why it costs what it costs? It's a complicated answer, but here in New England, much of these costs are controlled by a select group of stakeholders called the New England Power Pool, or NEPOOL. As New Hampshire Public Radio's Annie Ropeek reports, NEPOOL is now facing criticism for a lack of transparency and for decisions that could be raising the already high cost of energy in the region.
To understand why NEPOOL exists and what it has to do with your electric bills, we need to go back in time to 1965. It's a cold November evening, and New York City's WABC radio is playing the hits during rush hour. The frequency starts to wobble as high demand for electricity strains the power grid, made up of separate utilities with their own systems, from Toronto to New York to New England. Finally, somewhere in Ontario, a failsafe trips, sparking a chain reaction.
The lights are dimming in the studio. You wouldn't believe what's going on in the studio, folks.
Before this DJ or the region's utilities know what's happening, the grid goes down in a cascade of overloaded transmission lines and automatic shutoffs. An estimated 30 million Northeast residents are plunged into darkness. NBC's Robert Abernathy reported the news.
The Northeastern United States tonight suffered its worst electric power failure in history. There were massive traffic jams and confusion, especially at train stations.
The blackout of 1965 happened largely because the grid was too disjointed to easily absorb a human error. So when the lights came back on in the morning, the region's utilities decided things had to change. Here's New Hampshire's utility ratepayer advocate, Don Kreese.
They built a facility in Holyoke, Massachusetts, and each individual utility surrendered operational control of its transmission and generation facilities to this central dispatching facility, a big control room in Holyoke. And to facilitate that, they created an organization called the New England Power Pool.
NEPOOL ran the Northeast grid that way for a few decades. Then federal regulators proposed taking the model a step further. They wanted to set up new neutral nonprofits to manage each region's grid and energy market and to encourage more open competition with the big utilities. This gave us the Independent System Operator of New England, or the ISO. They're the current tenant in that Holyoke control room, and their only job is to keep the lights on. But NEPOOL didn't go away. It remained as a kind of trade group, and it kept a lot of power. It makes recommendations to the ISO on things like energy prices or the need for new transmission lines. Don Kreese says this means major decisions about energy in New England can still be made by industry.
We rely on markets to assure that the electricity grid is operated in the public interest. The markets are extremely complicated. The market rules are extremely complicated. And the market rules are debated at NEPOOL.
Kreese is actually a member of NEPOOL. Electricity customers and public officials do have a seat at the table, but NEPOOL's voting structure is weighted to give them less of a voice than, say, big utilities and power plant owners. Then there's what Kreese calls the jump ball provision. If NEPOOL members disagree with an ISO proposal, they can submit their own idea to the federal government, and regulators will basically pick between the two.
And that makes NEPOOL more powerful than the other stakeholder advisory boards at other regional transmission organizations around the country. That is a big deal.
Kreese and other critics say several times in recent years, federal regulators have favored NEPOOL proposals that wound up costing customers, helping make electric rates in New England some of the highest in the country. Kreese says a lot of these market changes could be seen as gold plating, adding endless backup measures and redundancies in the name of making the grid reliable. But members of the electric industry tend to think the structure in New England works just fine. Bill Quinlan is president of New Hampshire's biggest utility, Eversource. At a recent industry conference, he told me they're just trying to avoid a catastrophe like the blackout of 1965.
We don't believe we are overly conservative in the way we approach reliability. We never want to have an instance where the grid can't deliver the energy needed to keep a resident's lights on or a business going forward.
But there's one other problem that critics point to. The people that use that service aren't in the room when NEPL decides how much reliability is worth charging them for. Neither are news outlets. NEPL's meetings are closed to the public. That doesn't sit well with Tyson Slocum, a lobbyist with the group Public Citizen.
Under the current NEPL process, it is impossible for the public or for journalists to understand who originally came up with a market reform proposal.
On top of that, he says lobbyists for industry are allowed to sell the details they hear in those private meetings to outside parties. Slocum has joined media outlets and other watchdogs to put two complaints before federal regulators about NEPL's public access policies. One is about whether an energy industry journalist can join NEPL. The other says the closed-door policy violates federal law. NEPL's secretary and lawyer David Duke declined to be interviewed on tape for this story while those federal complaints are still unresolved. But he told me in writing that NEPL posts many of their records online and routinely talks to reporters about new market proposals. I asked if NEPL's public access policies and weighted voting structure could allow utilities to prioritize profits over keeping costs down for customers. Duke characterized this as a claim that NEPL members and federal regulators, quote, collectively have all been ineffective in ensuring balanced consideration of customers' interests. He continued, NEPL rejects that claim. But Tyson Slocum says NEPL's approach is unusual. Across the country, other regional grid operators and stakeholder groups let the public come to meetings and ask questions.
This is a serious breach of public trust committed by NEPL here. They are tasked by federal regulators to operate the only official electricity policy forum for the entire region. And they are saying members of the general public have no entitlement to attend or understand that process. And that's just deeply upsetting to me.
The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission is still considering the transparency challenges against NEPL. The cases could decide whether the organization must open its doors. And they could set a broader precedent about how much control federal regulators have over the groups they've tasked with keeping the lights on. For the New England News Collaborative, I'm Annie Ropeek.
For more of today's Maine news, visit our website, mainepublic.org. And from Maine Public, that's This Day in Maine for December 26th, 2018. Thanks to Susan Sharon, Willis Ryder Arnold, and Keith Shortall, and of course, our digital team. I'm Jennifer Mitchell.